Good morning. This is Hugh LaFollette, your host for Ideas Nations. On our program this week, I'm talking with Bert Bach, Provost and Professor of English at East Tennessee State University, and we're discussing Morris Dickstein's book, Leopards in the Temple, The Transformation of American Fiction. Bert, glad to have you on the show.
Thank you for asking me.
I wonder if you could begin by explaining the title, because someone who's not familiar with it might find it a bit odd. What's the background of the title, and how does it tie it in with the general thesis of his book?
Kafka wrote some parables near the beginning of the century, and one of the parables had to do with leopards breaking into the temple and disrupting a religious ceremony. They disrupted the ceremony by drinking from the sacrificial pitchers. The leopards continued to do this over and over and over again. Finally, in order to deal with this interruption, they simply projected that the leopards would continue to do this, built it into the ritual, and it became a part of the ceremony.
Okay. How does that apply to the transformation of American fiction?
Dickstein argues that, let's look first at really what has been a caricature of what happened after World War II. There's a common perception that there was a long, tranquil period in the 50s. It's been idealized. It has become caricatured as a kind of nostalgia. And then that this period suddenly evolved in the 60s with the kind of radical, characterized by the war, all kinds of issues that emerged at that time. Dickstein argues that it was not, in fact, a sudden revolution, but a steady evolution that had emerged over a period of time. And as with the leopards in the temple, that there were in fact some precursors, and that finally they were so frequent that those who had been the outsiders in the 50s became the insiders in the 60s.
Do you find his account of this change convincing?
Well, I think that if one looks at the period, there's a great deal about the caricature, as with many caricatures, is true. That is to say, the 50s, it was a period in which the stagnant government, small-minded, conventional thought, racial segregation, domestic restrictions on women, the rise of suburbia, these kinds of homogenizing impacts were very common. I can certainly recall that period as it being such. On the other hand, I think the point that he makes is that while the caricature has certain truths to it, there were exceptions, and the exceptions began over the period of time to increase in number and in kind. It is true that the 50s is associated with McCarthyism, but it's also true that the 50s is associated with the fact that McCarthyism was exposed. McCarthy was himself humiliated at the end of his period. It is true that the 50s one thinks of as a period of, for example, sexual repression, this kind of thing. But it was the period of the Kinsey reports that were published. It is true that it was a period in which labor unrest. John L. Lewis had some of his significant actions in this period with respect to the United Mine Workers. The 1954 desegregation case, these are certainly periods that it is certainly a period in which, while the caricature is true, there was a great deal happening. And writers began to reflect this, and he points out, I think quite accurately, that those writers who were exceptions in the 50s, the themes became much more common in the 60s, but it was not a revolution. It was an orderly evolution.
So he's not denying that, and you're not denying that there was change. What he's denying that there was the sort of radical change that sometimes people use to describe the difference between the 50s and 60s, that they really, the 60s was a definite outgrowth of the 50s.
Yeah.
Not a complete replacement of it.
No, and I think, in a sense, he was looking at a period really from 1945 to 1970. And at the end of the 60s, as people began to reflect on what the decade had meant, the 60s, we began to define the 50s in terms of the 60s. That is to say, if this kind of radicalism existed in the 60s, then it had to be the 50s had to be seen as a kind of 180 degrees from this. But it's I think his analysis of the writers who began to establish careers that lasted a long time. The writers who began writing in this period, some of them are still writing today. But the canon, the result of all of this activity was that, in fact, the canon of American literature, as we know it, changed. Many of the debates we have today about diversity issues as related to the canon, in fact, have their roots in this debate over what, in fact, happened in the 50s and 60s.
As you correctly pointed out, the book really goes back to 1945 at the end of World War II. And in some ways, in my reading of the book anyway, if you were going to locate the place which began more dramatic changes, it perhaps was really at the end of the war more than between the 50s and the 60s, both in terms of what was happening in the country and arguably what was happening within fiction itself. Are you inclined to read him in the same, at least in generally, in the same sort of way?
Well, I think that we could pick any date in time and we would be having some of the same kinds of quibbles about what its significance was. I mean, the 1920s were caricatured as the period of the flappers by Fitzgerald, but there were obviously a great number of people who were sober in the 20s. We think of the sinking of the Titanic as representing a period of time in which there was suddenly a question of what technology could do, of the Depression of 1929 as being the date in which suddenly our whole understanding of what our economic system means changed. But I think we would be having the same kinds of, if we pick 1945, we would be having, in a sense, the same kinds of quibbles, because some of the facts which he cites would have been relevant to that date also. Many of the writers who define what we thought of as modern fiction of the period, Faulkner, Hemingway, Fitzgerald, etc., were really coming to the ends of their careers, or at least major periods in which their major work had been defined. Others, writers, simply died on or around the end of the war. So I think that that to pick any particular time, whether it's 1950 or 1945 or 1960, the same kind of quibbles could be made about in the sense that things tend to evolve.
Okay.
There's
so in general, it's that change important change, significant change, doesn't tend to be radical. It tends to be gradual. It grows out of things that happened before and leads to things that happen subsequently.
I think that's true. I mean, we normally would say that the English Romantic period began with Wordsworth and Coleridge lyrical ballads. But I don't think anyone would say that suddenly in 1798 that this neoclassicism ended and the Romantic period began.
Well, I want to ask you just one other question about something you said a moment ago in or one of your answers. You said something like that the writers in the 50s and the early 60s began to reflect the change of their period. I mean, again, I think this is a perpetual question, but that way of saying it assumes that the changes are already occurring within society, and what writers do, what literature does, is reflect the changes that are already there. On the other hand, I can imagine some people saying, no, it's the other way around, that writers, artists are on the forefront of change. They're the ones who initiate change. Do you have any general comments about that? I mean, do you see this as one being the primary mover, or do you see them as being just deeply interrelated?
Well, I think that the alienation that emerged in the themes of many writers in the late 50s and in the 60s was not in total a part of their creation. They were reflecting an alienation from some of the existing values. The fact is that the voice of one of the major points that the book makes is that the voice of an American literature was becoming much more inclusive. We were not talking about an Eastern or Midwestern white Protestant male voice. We were talking about a Jewish voice. We were talking about a voice of African-American writers. We were talking about a voice of gay writers. We were talking about a voice of writers who were attempting to come to terms with a society in which, in some instances, they were outsiders. Flannery O'Connor in the South, a woman, a Catholic in the South, to write about some of the themes that she wrote, from my perspective, is accurately described in this book as being similar to Malamud's treatment of the Jewish merchant class in a book like The Assistant.
Well, I want to pause just for a moment for the benefit of anyone who has tuned in late. This is Ideas and Issues. My guest today is Bert Bock, Provost and Professor of English at East Tennessee State University, and we're discussing Morris Dickstein's book, Leopards in the Temple. I want to pick up on another theme that you mentioned earlier. You said, I believe actually a couple times, that a number of the people who began to make their name in the 40s and 50s are still writing. And that's, in some ways, it seems to me a very long time for someone to be a well-known, highly respected, highly productive, prominent writer. Maybe you could mention a couple of people that you specifically think have in mind when you made that comment. And is there anything significant about the fact that they've lasted so long as authors?
Well, I think if you contrast this group of writers with many of the writers who really gained their reputation in the 40s or in the 30s, you're dealing with writers who are much more talented. The fact is that if you take a writer like Flannery O'Connor or a writer like Ralph Ellison or Bernard Malamud, these are writers whose significance really resided in the quality of their work. Other writers really redefined themselves over a period of time. Norman Mailer, in a sense, did it several times. Salinger did it really on the basis of a single book, because he created a character, Holden Caulfield, who is timeless and has as much appeal for a kid today as it did 50 years ago. Writers like Roth, Updike, others, these are writers who've been writing for a very long period of time and are still writing. And I think the reason their reputation lasts is because they're fine writers.
I mean, it is intriguing that a book like Catcher in the Rye can seem to catch the imagination of so many people over such a relatively long period of time. I mean, obviously you have people like Shakespeare who can do it, but the number of people who we go back and avidly read 50 years later seems to be, well, it seems to be more a rarity than something that's common.
Well, if one thinks of the 1960s as representing the emergence of youth and the glorification of youth in the period, certainly that being a very common theme of the period, then Holden Caulfield's rejection of conforming to the society around him, his really becoming mentally unbalanced because of the attempt to conform, to be made to conform to this. This is a timeless. It's a timeless theme. One can find it in Huckleberry Finn, but with this writer, it became consonant with the time. The glorification of youth in the 60s certainly had as its precursor a book like that.
Okay. You've mentioned, I'd like to talk a little bit about some of the themes that come up time and again in this period. You've already mentioned two. Certainly they're going to be related. One is the glorification of youth. The second is alienation of people, particularly youth, from a culture that they see as a conformist culture. What are some of the other really important themes that you see as both emerging and lasting throughout this period?
I mentioned the theme of the energy of youth, sensitive children, thwarted adolescence. These kinds of themes certainly emerged. Violence in extreme situations, looked at in the light of the personality of characters within a work. One thinks of a book like Truman Capote's In Cold Blood or Norman Mailer's Executioner's Song. These novels about extremely violent murder, capital punishment issues, etc. A very common theme that emerged during this period were themes of mobility, restlessness, the theme of the road. That is certainly Jack Kerouac's On the Road, and the theme that it embodied is not unique to that book. It was a recurrent theme. Cynicism relative to stock responses to issues, disillusionment. A book like Catch 22, which is not just a war novel, but a book which has really defined. It has become in the dictionary, a kind of term for an irresolvable situation of the kind we may confront anywhere. Dysfunctional institutions. John Updike's The Rabbit series, looking at marriage and not just marriage, but any number of institutions being pictured as being dysfunctional. This is a common theme. Experience reflected in terms of consciousness of race or consciousness of gender or sexual orientation. Books like Ellison's Invisible Man, James Baldwin's books are certainly significant in that regard. Distinct cause refers to a relentless self-criticism as an alternative to complacency, as being a recurring theme, and it's certainly an important one that has lasted and became very apparent in the 60s.
And another sort of overarching theme, I suppose, is one you've mentioned a couple times earlier as well, and that is a celebration of diversity. That the presence of so many authors expressing so many different points of view that might not have been heard 30 or 40 or 50 years before suddenly not only are heard but are listened to, appreciated in a way they hadn't been before.
Yes, I think the in the final analysis, the importance of the writers who are studied in this book is that they redefined the canon, and redefined the canon in a much more inclusive way, and thus really served the study of these writers becomes a basis for the kind of debate we have over what is the canon? What is an American literature?
What people need to be reading.
Exactly.
In school. Okay. In fact, the question about what people need to be reading is arises from a comment that you made about this book. That in order, I mean, this book is an impressive work in part because it's clear that Dickstein has read a massive number of works and read them in detail. And when you read his description, it becomes clear sometimes that some of what he's read he doesn't think is especially good. That the very thing that allowed Dickstein to make his argument so convincingly was the fact that he seemed to be moderately indiscriminate about what he read, that he just read what was there. First of all, do you agree with that? If so, is there a lesson in here for the rest of us about the way we ought to approach our own reading?
Well, I think in the preface, Dickstein makes the point that he wanted to engage in a revaluation of this period in light of what had really been a love affair with reading, and as you say, an indiscriminate in many ways. He read books that in retrospect we say are very fine books, but he would also read Grace Natalia's Paper Place or books of this sort. But what is significant, this is a beautifully written book and a well-documented book, and I think it could only be documented in the kind of convincing fashion than it is if he were able to refer to this broad scope of reading.
Okay. Well, now, the other thing that's actually related to this is in his sort of overview of the period, you get the sense that he sees the novel as being of declining importance. First of all, do you agree with that assessment? Well, and what I mean by declining importance here isn't necessarily that they're not good novels. It's that they don't seem to play the role in most people's lives. They don't seem to play the role, perhaps, in our culture that they might have once played. What do you think about that?
Well, Dickstein makes a very clear argument relative to this issue. He says that in many ways the novel became more self-conscious as it became less central to reflecting the culture of the period. He believes that new forms, journalism, the personal essay, visual media, the politics of theater, etc., emerged to do many things which the novel had done in earlier eras. He also observes that the novel, if one thinks in the 30s that the novel dealt with the issues, the broad issues, but in many instances was relatively weak in character, in plot, in some of the aesthetic dimensions of fiction, that as the novel became better, it dealt in some instances on fewer occasions with these kinds of issues, and the void was picked up by these other forms.
Okay. We're almost out of time. I'm wondering if you would give the benefit of your own extensive reading to the listeners. If you were going to pick some novels in this period that you think are especially important, that you might encourage some of the listeners to pick up and read themselves, what might some of them be?
Well, I certainly think that Malamud is a fine writer. A book like The Assistant, like The Natural, like The Fixer. From my perspective, those are his three finest novels. We've already talked about The Catcher in the Rye, which most everyone has read, and I think will continue to read for generations to come. Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man, I think, is a novel that will last. Certainly, the stories of Flannery O'Connor are significant. The John Updike's Rabbit series is a very, very significant work. Saul Bellow, any number of these writers are, I think, significant for aesthetic reasons as well as for some of the cultural reasons that we've talked about this morning.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for appearing on the show today. I've been speaking today with Bert Bock, Provost and Professor of English at East Tennessee State University. We've been discussing Morris Dickstein's book, Leopards in the Temple. This is Hugh LaFollette for Ideas and Issues. Good day.